Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate everybody taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for that esteemed cohort that is with us live, I'd always like to give a reminder that we enjoy the interplay that we have with our live crew. So at the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. If you are so inclined, please go ahead and head down there. We'll be monitoring during the course of the show. And if you have some observations you'd like to share, you want some clarification on something you might have heard, or if there's even a question you would like for us to ask our guests that you hope that we can get to before the show is over, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. And if you got to go take care of some business and you want to catch up on part of the show that you may have missed, or for future episodes you just can't join us here on a Sunday, remember, if you don't already, head on over to iTunes, Spreaker, or whichever aggregator you work for your podcast, and go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. It's free. You get what you pay for. And that way you can catch Midrats at a time that's more convenient for your busy schedule. And speaking of busy schedules, we have a great show today with a couple of gentlemen who are going to take time to help us do a little bit of time travel, because there is part of the story, both writ large, with the American contribution, but also the naval contribution to the two-decade-long conflict that we had in Afghanistan, that involved a lot of Navy personnel. And Afghanistan, as anybody who knows, has got a globe or a map in front of them, it is a landlocked nation. And a lot of people, some of the listeners here I know that have reached out to me, they may be Navy, but they've served in Afghanistan, whether you're talking about the Navy corpsmen that went with the Marines, or various reserve component and active duty components who got that nipper email telling them that congratulations on this significant career milestone. You've been selected for individual augmentation tour. And a lot of other folks that heard billets were available, they threw their hat in the ring, whether they're working on the U.S. or the Allied component, they went over to Afghanistan. However, there were units, in addition to the CBs, that were predominantly Navy that also served. And one of those were with the Provisional Reconstruction Teams, or PRTs, as we'll talk to them today, that were in Afghanistan. And that's what we're going to talk about today. For the full hour, we're going to look at a snapshot, too, of the Afghan conflict at the high water mark. High water mark being when we had the most forces there. And in the 2011 time frame, we maxed out at over 100,000 U.S. military personnel there, which when we were in the just low four figures last 2 years, and even more of allied components that I think brought up the maximum to like 130,000 to 140,000 on top of that as well. And today, for the full hour from that high water mark, 2010 and 2011, our guests are Captain Steve Deal, United States Navy retired, and Command Sergeant Major Alexander Bo Barnett, U.S. Army retired. They serve together as the commanding officer and sergeant major for the Provisional Reconstruction Team and Coast from 2010 to 2011. Steve and Bo, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, good evening. Thanks, Sal and Eagle One. This is Steve for having Bo and myself on your show. And thanks for bringing us together. It's been very cathartic. We were supposed to be on the show maybe a few weeks ago, and I flew down to Mobile to see Bo, and it didn't happen. So that was wonderful to get to see me again on the pontoon boat, having a great time. And then now that we rescheduled it, he came up here to Vermont, where I've created my own witness protection program to escape from D.C. So It's great to be here, and we've had 10 years to think about what we saw and did. And, of course, the events of this last summer concentrated our minds quite a bit, along with many other veterans. I'm sure that will come up. Bo, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing? Hey, Sal and Eagle One, thanks for having me on the team. I know I'm among some good Navy friends as I took my trip from the, you know, south of Baldwin County, Alabama, where the weather's a whole lot nicer, you know, got 80-degree weather. Now I'm sitting in Vermont, you know, it's so cold up here, and I'm looking at the water of Lake Champlain, but I can't figure out why I have a fleece jacket on and a ball cap and my gloves, because I think this young Navy captain won't turn the heat up for me because he wants me to feel like I'm in Afghanistan, I think. I'm not sure. But thanks, guys.
Well, Bo, we really appreciate you coming on board here. And that's probably one thing we can fold into the conversation, too, is even though, you know, we're talking about a, quote, Navy, unquote, PRT, every PRT had members from the different services there to complete it and to get it all wrapped up. And I guess we can start with you or Steve, whichever one is more comfortable with. But for our guests who may not have the expertise, I think it's always good, when in doubt, go to the map, go to the chart, go to the sand table, whatever. But, you know, I mentioned in the intro that 2010, 2011, that was the high water mark for the number of forces we had. We had completed the surge or the uplift of forces, whatever you want to talk about there. It was a very, very different part of the conflict than what a lot of people in the last decade have been used to. But let's take that little snapshot of PRT Coast. Where is it on the map? Who was there? How many were there? And what did you all see as your mission?
Okay, great question. Well, first off, you know, a lot of people call it a Navy PRT. It wasn't really even a Navy majority in the population of the PRT. It was joint interagency, as you think just said. And so we had Army Reserves, Army Active Duty, same with Navy, and National Guard, 42 members of the Massachusetts National Guard as our security platoon, two Air Force folks for PA, a State Department, USAID, a host of Afghan enablers and partners. Some were volunteers like me and Bo. Some others were voluntold. We were all there, and it was a pretty big production. You know, we all meet at Camp Atterbury. We had 11 PRTs at that time that were U.S.-led. Six were supposedly Navy and five Air Force, but, of course, we all were intermixed. So we had engineers, project managers, health experts, diplomats, aid experts, small medical staff there on the team. You know, the Afghan contractors did the work, not the PRT. And although we weren't a combat unit, we were the centerpiece of the counterinsurgency effort there within the battle space owner. I'm going to let Bo talk more about how we were set with the Army overarching the mission and the command structure there. Go ahead, Bo.
Okay, gentlemen. So as Steve just spoke about how we were set up and how we were assembled at Atterbury, you know, 72 days of training. And so the Army knew that we had to get this PRT ready to go do a mission, that, you know, the security was our number one focus on securing the PRT. Even though we had a Navy commander and we had an Army Sergeant Major, everybody in this group brought a skill set to this formation, whether it be engineering, whether it be water purification, whether it be wells, whether it be schools, whether it be the FET teams, female engagement teams. However, we needed a SEC-4, which is that, you know, awesome platoon come out of the 181 out of Boston that supported this whole operation. And then we were set in a location, which was Coast, which I already had some stock in that formation because I just spent a year and some change there before I met Steve back in 2003 to 2004. So it was a win-win when they matched myself and Captain Dill up together. Also, you know, every good captain in the Navy needs a good sergeant major to keep it straight. Thanks.
Yeah, and let me add to the mission piece there too. I mean, you know, so we went into Afghanistan after 9/11. And because the Taliban were harboring al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, I think the America writ large was looking for some sort of revenge, I think. Safe to say, I mean, a little Old Testament, you know, retribution. And also we want to make sure it could never happen again, right? So Never again would Afghanistan be a safe harbor for those who want to attack the United States or our allies. And, you know, and then Iraq happened in 2003, and a whole lot of resources went up there and not so much to Afghanistan. You know, with, I think Admiral Mullen had said at one point, we did what we could in Afghanistan, but in Iraq we do what we must. And so, you know, after General Petraeus went up to Iraq, and in the middle of that civil war, really, and tried to focus on counterinsurgency efforts and, you know, wrote the 3TAC-24, the counterinsurgency manual, and, you know, counterinsurgency was kind of a tactic masquerading as a strategy, I think. You know, that those thoughts, those tenets came over to Afghanistan because at some point Afghanistan, you know, it was hoped, could create a nation, a government, that would stand on its own, and really the mission of the PRT was to try to connect those leaders to the local populace to show that the Jarrah, the government of Afghanistan, Islamic Republic, was Islamic, was could provide services to the people, was legitimate, and we were working behind the scenes to provide commander's emergency response funds to contractors there to build things that the leaders themselves thought they needed. So, like Bo said, you know, women's health centers, government centers, clinics, roads, schools, irrigation systems, medical clinics, a hospital, power and utilities. As you both know, and the audience rose, you know, through the special investigator, investigative general there for Afghan reconstruction that was looking at us as kind of a watchdog for the whole time. And I think they did a great job. You know, a lot of these projects went awry. There were some in Coast already there that when we showed up that, you know, we knew that, like a hospital that was built that, you know, it was crumbling as they built it. There was a utilities plant, power plant that was awash. People would steal the copper out of the plant before it could ever become operational. So there were these monuments to failure in throughout Coast like they were across Afghanistan. But, you know, what we tried to do was create smaller projects that connected the leaders to the people. And I think that was the centerpiece of our mission. Go ahead.
Well, as you look back on it, you know, 10 years in the rearview mirror, as you say, your mission wasn't to do the work, but to ensure that the work was done, and you were working in the background to make that happen. You know, did you think when you left that we were on the road to making things better for the Afghanis, or that they were making it better for themselves?
Okay, well, I answer first, and let Bo follow up with what he thinks. But I did see violence decreasing while we were there, and I thought that was the main metric, that people felt like they could volunteer for civic activities. We weren't going to create a nation there in a year, or, you know, a war fought differently year after year for 20 years with different rotations of people. But I think for our mission and how we felt strongly about it was connecting people to civic society. So having people to come and volunteer to run women's health centers or come teach school, to do those kind of things for the public, that's a very Western mentality. You know, that it's not an Afghan's way of thinking to go beyond the family. Pashtun Wali and all those code of conduct that they have, you know, those are established over 1,000 years since Genghis Khan came over the hills, and then Alexander the Great, and, you know, on down the line to the British, the Russians, and us. And so, you know, we would go from a coolie to coolie, village to village, 150 meters apart, and one couldn't talk to the other. It couldn't understand one another. And you multiply that times 100,000, you know, this wasn't a nation ripe for nation building. This is a nation that was kind of balkanized through evolution so that they could survive. And so we didn't really, you know, what we saw when we were there were people standing up to become active in society. And those were the wins that I saw, as well as the security piece. In Coast West, I think, increased over that time. So I'll pass it to Bill and what he thinks.
Okay, I'm going to add to what, you know, Captain Dill just said. Yeah, I think we made a big difference. And I'm going to put it in two parts here. So the first is like, you know, we was trying to help a nation become, you know, a joint effort by showing that we had different branches of service, you know, Navy, Army, Coast Guard, Marine, State Department, all those folks are trying to help Afghanistan, you know, their own feet. I think we made some mistakes on how we went forward to, you know, throwing some kind of, you know, money at a problem versus throwing leadership at a problem, which in turn, the security part of it, you know, like Steve brought up about the hospital, you know, we built this thing and then we just left it sitting there and, you know, we just secured it some kind of way, you know. So, of course, people will go in and, you know, take what they want to take from it. Every province had their own problem, but I think in Coast, we were getting somewhere because we connected the governor, Governor Naimi, to, you know, the battle space and let him see what we got going on through the PRT. You know, we weren't there to just, you know, blaze guns and do those things. That wasn't our mission, even though I'm an infantry guy, but my job was to help build and, you know, get the infrastructure to where it's supposed to be. And I saw it getting there, but I think that we didn't put enough of our leadership and let them be a part of it, and we try to make it a westernized country, which is never going to happen because they have a different mindset.
And let me add one more thing there to that. I don't think many people know that we were at FOB Chapman, Forward Operating Base Chapman, and Coast is kind of this protruding bowl, you know, surrounded by very high mountainous territory, and so you know, kind of in its own element there, but protruding into Pakistan. And Coast City might as well have been Quetta or any of the other Pakistani cities there. It was very much Pakistani influenced. And so I think it's known out there that this is, you know, the CIA base there. There are partners there or next to us. And so we were kind of a, you know, unclassified bowling ball rolling down the alley. And you had, we would make impacts with the people in the populace. And there are a lot of levels of war watching this, covert, clandestine, secret, ranger regiment, all that. And so while we were doing our counterinsurgency bit, there was a huge counterterrorism and force-on-force mission as well going on at the same time. So hopefully that makes sense. Go ahead.
That's one thing about Coast that I think is interesting. I always encourage people to get out their map, preferably one that's not just Afghanistan, because where y'all were – y'all know this better than I do. It's right there. It borders, a lot of it borders to the south. North Waziristan in the federally administered tribal area, Spata, from Pakistan. And that is the wild, wild west of the wild, wild west of the modern world. Right there in the heart of it. And at that point in time, you're right there at the heart of also Regional Command East, which is the part the U.S. ran. And we're in the process of transitioning south, which was up until the Canadians finally left, was the, you know, the British and the Canadians and the Dutch and RC South. And, of course, you had the Germans and the Scandinavians up in the north, the Italians and the Spaniards in the west. But when you look at trying to get to know it, I one of the guys, you know, I was, full disclosure, as a NATO ISAF officer for years. This is partially my fault, so I'll take a little bit of the blame for that. But when he was helping us in 08-09, you know, one of the things that he said early on in the conflict when he did his tour in RC East, he says by the time he left, he realized that these guys, and I think he was either up in Nuristan or Wardak up to the north of it, he said these are just a bunch of hillbillies that they've been here forever. They just want to be left alone so they can do their illegal lumber trade, and they don't know us. And right northwest of your province is Paktia province, and that was the first place that there was a PRT. And there's a little note that I got out of a NATO document. It was even worse than I thought. From 03 to 11, basically 8 years, there were 14 rotations through that PRT of teams. And when we look back at the things that y'all learned while you were there, I think the people that came before you and people that came after you, you develop some institutional knowledge and some local knowledge. It helps you do your job better, helps you support the locals better, help you support our mission better as well. And, you know, y'all were there much longer than 6 months that some of the Native people did rotations at. But when you got through with your tour there, how much of your institutional knowledge do you think are on average for all PRT turnovers? If you're only going to be there for a year or so, how much of that institutional knowledge can you actually turn over to the next team? Or do they re-baseline at a high percentage, whereas the locals, they're there, they always have been there, they always will be there? How did that rotation impact our ability to try to get some leverage and some footage?
Yeah, another great question, Sal. I mean, first, you know, we all started at Camp Atterbury, like Bo said, 72 days when we all met until we were in the combat zone, which is an amazing feat in itself, and we all met. And before that, the sergeant majors and the COs, we went out to Afghanistan and did kind of a pre-deployment trip. So we went out there to coast, and we were probably, it took about 3 weeks to spend a week there and learning and listening, talking to the brigade commander there and ISAF. We went to Coin Academy, which is right there in Kabul near the Queen's castle and all that. So a lot of training with regard to, you know, what was going on. And then, you know, we had folks coming into Camp Atterbury, Indiana, about an hour south of Indianapolis, I think, you know, the joint base there. And so Afghans and State Department folks, AID, whatnot, giving us lessons learned as we went through that training. I think it was excellent training. It was tough training. Not everybody was prepared for the physicality and the grit of it. But, you know, they gave us a great launching point, whereas, you know, 72 days of pretty much 24/7 training to the point where we fly out there and then did a right seat, left seat ride with the PRT in place. So, our whole PRT was there at Chapman while the previous rotation was there. It wasn't like an aviation squadron where we would send people out and send others back and pretty much the same planes in the ramp were there because of whatever issues, diplomatic or whatnot, for how many planes you can have on the ramp. We had the whole thing, both teams there at Chapman at the same time. And it happened that we were under attack at one of the nights when or was getting ready to be attacked. And so we learned pretty quickly what was going on at the time. So I think we adequately knew what had happened in the past, and we were able to put together a plan for the future in our time. Go ahead, Bo.
And I'm going to add to that. So, you know, as Steve talked about, you know, how we did the, you know, right seat, left seat ride with both PRT teams. And then when our team, you know, Steve and everybody packed up to leave, they left the lone survivor, you know, myself there, which the team that came in, and I stayed an extra month with those guys, you know, not because I wanted to, but because it was the right thing to do. And I helped those guys transition into this formation because I'm an Army active duty sergeant major, and then we moved from Chapman over to Solano, and this formation was going to be under the fall of another brigade, a battle space owner. And so it was some carryover, even though it was, you know, bittersweet, even I departed, but it helped that team, that commander that was in charge, say, hey, I'm glad that you were here with us for an extra 30 to 45 days, Bo, to help us transition, because I saw what happened the last, you know, 10 months in Coast, and it was an easy transition, and which I think that's what we should have did, you know, carrying on. But my reason for staying was for because they couldn't fill the position, and I had to stay until we got someone to come, you know, take my position. So it was a win for the incoming team, but a loss for myself to stay an extra, you know, 45 days.
And, of course, I was accused of abandoning him, and he'll never forgive me. Go ahead.
Well, now you bring him up to Vermont to freeze to death. I think he's got some scores to settle with you there, Steve. When I was briefly involved with the Kosovo thing, one of the things I noticed in the civil-military cooperation world I was working in was that there was a little bit of tension between the military forces and the non-governmental organizations. And I've noticed that that's also been mentioned in some of the stuff I've read about what you guys were doing with the PRTs in Afghanistan. Can you talk about that a little bit, and also about the maybe a misapprehension on the part of the Afghanis as to whether you were military counterterrorism guys, or are there to help them help themselves?
Okay, that sounds like a two-part question. So,
that's where I get my cheap shots in, Steve.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple too. I mean, so we had a civilian military strategy on paper, but in reality, we had no strategy at all between the two. I mean, they're completely separate teams. I used to say that, if Taliban and the Haqqani network ran away and decided to go away for a year, we'd still be fighting our wars on the email for a while until we figured out they were gone because of all the tension between the state AID, the leadership. It just took the coherence of interdepartmental, interagency activities such as big as that was horrible. And so there are a lot of, when you're out there in the middle of nowhere, a lot of personality conflicts and whatnot. Near the end of our rotation, the new division commander came in, and after we briefed him, he wanted to know what was going on with the civilians out there. How come our brigade commander wasn't working better with them? And it was a big, big issue all the way up to ISAF. So I see that dysfunction happening well before us and well after, and to the things that you saw this summer with the disconnect of the strategy and how we, executed our exfil there in Kabul and Bagram. So that was a huge problem. And as far as the Afghans and how they saw us, I don't think they saw any of those scenes or anything. The PRT before us had put a stencil on our MRAPs, as a Navy Trident. That thing probably saved us from getting IED'd more than anything else because they realized we were the money. And so when we went to town to town or whatnot, we were never attacked. We did have a couple incidents where we had to dismount and defend ourselves, but thank goodness, we never got IED'd. I think they knew we were coming. They knew what role we played. And the last thing I'll say about this before passing the bow is I'm glad that we were that unclassified unit coming in, making the carry-ons because, we would go to different district centers and not knowing what had happened the night before, a night raid or a bombing attack with civilian casualties. And, Afghans can tell a liar a mile away. It's inbred in them after thousands of years. And had I known and gone there anyway to try to, salve the wounds or provide money or whatever, we would have lost all credibility. But I had no idea those things were happening. And so, again, another part of the discord, but I thought it was an advantage because there's no way I could explain this kind of things away and still kept our relationship with the Afghan people. So hopefully that answers your question. Bo, do you have anything? No?
I don't have anything.
Well, first of all, the comments about the interagency, it's especially 5 or 6 weeks ago, everybody started to talk about accountability and truth and reconciliation committees or something like that. And I always kind of set my teeth on edge because I remember in 08, 09 in Kabul trying to work with USAID and the State Department on a few things. If we're going to do that, that's great, but it can't be just DOD that's at the table. I really want to see the State Department. I want to see USAID. I want to see a couple other little acronyms, people up there, because next time we do this, if it's only the U.S. military that's really publicly look back at what we did and how we did it, and those other agencies who, at least in my experience, more often were not part of the solution, then we're going to repeat a whole bunch of the errors. And one of the errors, error is probably not the right way of putting it, and this is probably somebody will answer this question in a PhD dissertation. But I was looking back at one of the articles you shared with me, Steve, back in January 2011, and especially with all that's happened since then and some of the grief that folks get writing PAOs, which sometimes isn't fair. You got to give credit for then First Lieutenant Ken Schultz, for putting this in his article, is what type of cultural blindness did we have in that a lot of what we were trying to do was to build a strong economy. And when they were interviewing the, I believe it was the Naimi, the governor, he stated that
Naimi,
quote,
yep.
Yeah, he said, quote, "It is clear the insurgents want nothing good for Afghanistan," he said. "The ISAF forces have brought us an army, schools, and roads. The insurgents bring none of this," unquote. And we were there for another decade after this. And obviously, whatever we were doing to help supply those things and to help them build an economy, not just in Coast Province, but throughout the country, it simply wasn't enough. And I always used, not always, the last couple of months, always use this one little data point that when the Soviets left Afghanistan, they went over the Friendship Bridge with their last armed forces. The government and the military that they set up lasted 38 months before it collapsed. We were there much longer than the Soviets were, and ours didn't even make it 1 month. So, you know, why was what we did, do you think, to supply those things that the governor was referring to, was just not enough? And was it really not doable, in hindsight, was it just not doable regardless of how much we wanted it to be?
Yes, another great question. Bo and I are looking at each other the whole time while you're speaking there. Serious thoughts. I mean, you know, you think of those who gave the last measure of devotion for this mission first. I mean, how many times have you run out at Bob Salerno, or maybe a ramp ceremony? That means when, you know, someone who had fallen was going on a helicopter being flown out on the way to Dover. And I'm looking at a press release here of casualty status of October 13th of this year of Operation Enduring Freedom. And Afghanistan, only 2,218 deaths, 1,833 killed in action, 385 of them were non-hostile, over 20,000 wounded in action. Afghans who were killed with civilian casualties, I've read things from 60,000 to 100,000. And so when you add, and then the impact on all their families, and then the suicide rate being four times higher than those who in the civilian world who hadn't served, it's a very serious question of, was it worth it? You know, did we make a difference? And so, I mean, the first thing I would do is thank all those who served and try to make a difference. It's a very difficult thing. I think it's one of the hardest things we've ever asked any young woman or man serving in uniform at any time in their nation's history to become a counterinsurgent. I mean, what you have to do is be open, engaging, try to learn the history of another country that's completely different than yours, a language that you're trying to understand, just to speak Davy Pashto or Dari to someone to make a connection, not wearing uniforms, trying to connect them to a government that they did not elect, that they had no idea, you know, trying to connect them to people who were hoping, you know, that this plan worked. And at the same time, you had to be able to flip like a light switch in a half a second and be able to shoot them in the face as you had to. And then the positions of, we put these same 18, 19-year-olds on guard duty or whatnot, and they had to make a split decision on whether that car coming in had AID or a suicide bomber, and to either, you know, disable that vehicle or not. And those decisions have not just consequences there on the battlefield, of course, but consequences for the rest of their lives. You got to think about that. You're on the battlefield for the rest of your life, and that's one of the things Bo and I talk about here. We're still there in a lot of ways. So, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it's a very serious thing to talk about. You know, was it worth it? Did we do the right thing? Did we make a difference? Bo, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I mean, it's a tough question. Did we make a difference? You know, of course we made a difference. I mean, we were there. What I think, coming from my foxhole, I'm speaking on what, you know, Command Sergeant Major Barnett, you know, Bo Barnett, you know, a young kid from Alabama, you know, I believe and I felt like we had a chance to do an audible throughout these 20 years. And, you know, everybody says, you know, like you said these 13, you know, sailors and soldiers were killed, right? You know, what was the plan? Did we have a plan to come out of Afghanistan? Of course we had a plan. I mean, I think we had a plan. I mean, no Department of Defense, you know, we got plans on the shelves that pick a place in the Pentagon that extraction and searching, you know, special operations, you know. So, but what I think we didn't do well, this is coming from my foxhole, is we didn't set the conditions based on the environment for us to do what we need to do to come out of Afghanistan. You know, we went in, you know, on three different administrations, and then we all want to look at one person and say, hey, this is their fault. No, this we're a nation, and we're at war. Everybody that's supporting the defense of their formation, whether it be Afghanistan, whether it be Iraq, whether it be the United States. I mean, everybody, you know, how sadly we forgot that we were attacked in 2001. And now the only thing we remember is, how about those planes flying by and dropping people off? You know, those pilots took off and, you know, did what they were taught to do, and we want to start blaming people. I think we got to go back and look at, why were we there? Why were we there? That's the problem. That's what we got to answer.
Yeah, I just want to piggyback on that. I mean, we all love the quote Clausewitz, right? You know, the on war sounds like it has nothing to do with what we're doing. But there's this quote that always, you know, I underlined a long time ago and it keeps hitting me. The most far-reaching act the statesman and the commander have to make is to establish the kind of war in which they are embarking, never mistaking it for or trying to turn it into something that is alien to its nature. And you think about that, you know, as Americans over our wars of, you know, 250 years almost, and how often did we look into what was the nature of the war we're going into? Did we understand the people, the cultural concept? What mattered? What were the values of those folks? Instead of trying to plan our own Western vision of that. And, you know, that was probably one of the biggest failures, I think, overall. Go ahead.
Now, some of us have talked about Afghanistan was probably a good location for a punitive expedition rather than an extended operation. But, you know, we tend not to do that because we want to make things, you know, you break it, you buy it sort of theory. But I'm really fascinated by what you said earlier about, I'm confused about, and this is my ignorance, but the Taliban seems to be more national or a larger force than the forces that are run by the families and the tribes in Afghanistan. Are they extra tribal? Are they bigger than they people draw people from all kinds of tribes? Or are they such a distinct group that the people just want to be left alone in their, and I think you said in their towns where they didn't even talk to their neighbors? You know, I get confused how that role worked and what you saw to try and that we could have done if we just, you know, were to stay longer, even if we could have broken that down, or that's just impossible given the culture of the Afghanis.
You know, when we watched all those horrific events, you know, I was just sickened over the summer with folks dropping off planes. We weren't surprised by that at all. When we saw them running, I sent the pictures to my former XO and Bo here, and one of them, we knew some of those guys were going to climb on, try to ride with them. None of us wanted to stay long or as long as we did. There's plenty of opinions about how long we should have stayed. Should it have been after Osama bin Laden was killed? Should we have stayed, you know, after 2014 maybe and left? Just many different, interstitial points where, you know, you could have made that decision. But unfortunately, it was always based on political conditions and what politician leaders at the time felt like was viable for that. You know, as far as I know, the Afghan people, what I saw and I outside the wire every day talking to them, they're a peaceful people who just want the best for their children. We have so much more in common than we ever could apart. They love education. They love reading. I used to give gifts to leaders and families and stuff like that, and the most honored gift I could give them was a pen. You know, remember those? And so, you know, they want a better life for themselves and their children. They realize that they
Did we just drop sync somewhere?
I think we did. Bo, are you there? We lost Steve.
I'm here. Can you hear me? Hey, guys, you hear me? I'm there. Can you hear
me? Yep. We hear you fine,
I think
Bo.
We lost Steve for a second.
How about now?
There you go. Okay, I think you're back, Steve.
He's on my head. Okay. You know, there's a peaceful people that want the best for their children, is my point. And in the Taliban or shadow government, I think we know the origins of the Taliban, the students over in Pakistan and the ISI and others who had funded them. And so, they were watching everything we were doing and ready to capitalize on the resources we were providing. So, it's no question to us, or it was no surprise to us that, when they rode through and showed the flag and realized we were leading, peace-loving Afghans, they've seen enough war. They've seen not 20 years of it, but 40, 50 years of it, their whole life. So, of course, they didn't want any more of that. And, and again, they're at least. For us.
I think we lost Steve again. Bo, are you up? Bo or Steve?
Check.
Somebody drop an EMP on top of Vermont?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Is that you, Bo?
Hey, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Hello? I think some of the problems are typically watch is saying, 20 degrees right now, so I think what happened. I think
equipment
my computer's phone, my iPhone is like 6 years old. I think it has a temperature control button where it stops working. Young captain here, he's got a lot of money, but he won't spend, turn the heat on. And he has a 1979 iPhone. I think that's maybe frozen in it. So I'm not sure what's going on.
Well, Bo, while he tries to find a charger or get a signal next to the window, let me roll a question to you here. Getting a little bit of feedback in the background, but when NATO started the PRT program, I keep wanting to say we because I wore that hat, but one thing that was done was it looked back at some of the civil affairs experience the Americans had in Vietnam. Matter of fact, when I was at HQ ISAF, I worked around or at least shared a cigar occasionally with what had to be the oldest U.S. Army major I'd ever run into before in my life. He was actually recalled from retirement because of the experience he had in civil affairs during the Vietnam War. Old man Winter walking around in his major's uniform, he kind of joked that his wife found out how that could adjust his retirement pay. So she told him that he had to get in physical shape so he could be brought back on active duty. Break. As we know, that at some point, it might be next year, it might be next decade, it might be a few decades now, but at some point, somewhere on the globe, the United States will find itself either by itself or in a coalition with other nations having to do, again, something similar to what the civil affairs teams did in Vietnam, and Bo, you and Steve and your sailors and soldiers and airmen did in Afghanistan, being called something different, but basically a civil affairs, a PRT type system. When you look back at what y'all did, and especially with the one decade of hindsight, if you're able to time travel to you're the command sergeant major of the future that's about to walk over to help set up one of these teams, what are the top three or top five things you would want to make sure that you could sit down with them and say, you need to focus on this, or you need to remember this, or you need to emphasize this?
Okay, let's make sure you hit me before I start, getting on my soapbox here. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, you can hear me, right?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, so if I can go, I know people say, well, if you could do something better, if you could Monday morning quarterback this thing, or you can help the future. I'm going to touch a small portion of what I think if I had the chance to be the Sergeant Major of the Army or any type of leadership to go and get ready for this again is, one, we're going to talk about readiness. When I say readiness, it's going to be readiness and three pillars. The first pillar is we've got to be combat effective readiness. It's like we got to make sure that everyone that we send to this formation, we prepare them for what they're going to encounter. You know, we have to set numbers up. I don't know if you know, when you were in the Navy, we had this bubble chart. You know, we had to go, you know, red, green, or amber, you know, and give it to our leadership. And, you know, when I first came in the Army back in the 90s, it was like zero defect. Hey, no, we can't, we're not going to set up any bad news. No, nobody wants, no commander is going to say to their leader, hey, I'm not ready to go to combat. Because if you're not, then they'll be like, we'll get out of the way. We'll put another somebody else in charge. So readiness is important. Two is psychologically we have to be prepared for this thing. You know, whatever you're going to encounter, pick a country that we have to go back into. We have to make sure that our, you know, sailors, you know, airmen, our soldiers, our you know, civilian folks, pick a three-letter agency, make sure that we are set on the homeland security before we leave here, because it's hard. Like Steve said, we're asking America's sons and daughters to go do something that's bigger than themselves, and then they got a weapon in their hand, but we got to go, how can I help you? You know, what I'm here for to do, you know, make your better. And then we're not sure the next day that same individual I'm talking to is going to, you know, harm me or someone that's next to me. Now I got to shoot this guy in the face because I was just talking to him the other day about a well. So it's very difficult. The last thing is leadership. We can't call the shots from the press box. This is not football, you know what I mean? We can't have the guy up in the press box, the offensive coordinator, be like, hey, run, do this different. No, you got the guys on the ground should be helping make some of these decisions. That's where I think we have to use some of the things you said before. How do we get better? Take information from the folks on the ground, like myself, you know, and Steve Deal, give it to our leadership, but hey, and let's make a decision. So first, readiness. And I'm talking about true readiness, not – you know, bubble chart. Like, hey, are we really ready? Are we 85%, you know? And then if we are 85%, let's make it 90%, whatever we got to do. We're not just going to send folks into this war over the 20 years. The second thing is we have to be mentally prepared for this. You know, when I went back in 2003, you know, I was a scout platoon sergeant, and, you know, one of my other best friends, Dave Powell, you know, he was a first sergeant. I'm not sure we were mentally prepared for this. You know, we were like, you know, I could shoot my weapon, I could hit a target, I could go to the range, could do all those things, but I don't think we were mentally prepared. And last, like I said, let me share our homeland. You know, we train our families. Hey, here's what I'm going to go do. And I know we got some operational security things there, but, you know, the biggest and best resources we have as the Department of Defense is the families back at home that supported us.
I have something to add there, too, if you can hear me. My 1970s phone here works. Can you hear me there, Sal? Equal one.
Gotcha.
Sure can.
Okay. Well, I mean, to Bo's point, I just wanted to piggyback on, you know, that after Vietnam, you know, General Abrams declared we're not going to war again without calling up the reserves. And so we had the thing called the Abrams Doctrine, where we made sure that if we were going to go overseas again for a long campaign that required a lot of logistics and things, that we were going to embed the critical pieces of that into the National Guard reserves. And, you know, those National Guard reserves were not. They're incredibly loyal, courageous people. But I'm not sure we did enough for them and our active duty, but mostly for them to prepare for this. And, you know, we had this story we talk about when we were at Camp Atterbury, and we had just joined. And after about 2 weeks, we went to an Applebee's, or the most enlisted folks did, you know, just to get away and pull off some steam, get a cheeseburger. And three of our National Guard, you know, brothers were there at a table and not ordering. And Bo went up to them to find out what was going on. And they had been living under a railroad trestle for, you know, months, waiting to be called up. They had no money. And they were completely in it, part of a subsistence economy on the on our war out there. They really couldn't have – they're from South Boston, really hard-scrabble backgrounds, some tear-breaking – tear-jerking stories about their lives. And yes, they wanted to serve. Yes, they wanted to make a difference, but that's all they really had. And I think any of the lesson learned I would go back to is, you know, we have to understand the second order effects on those people who come from the civilian sectors and have to serve over and over again to make ends meet. I think that's the most important thing to me, because at the end,
when they come home, all those issues for themselves, either suicide rates or their families, many kinds of alcohol, drug, whatever problems are exacerbated, and it's a shame for all of us who served. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Steve, because as a reservist, you got called up for Desert Storm and had a unit, was command of a unit. There were guys in my unit had businesses, and they were sole proprietors, and yet they deployed, and we didn't know how long we were going to be gone. But that you would think that after the experience of calling up all the reservists for Desert Storm, that someone would have been paying attention to that. But I can assure you, judging by my current reserve friends, that a lot of those lessons have not been learned, and I'm sure they haven't been learned by the National Guard and a lot of the other folks. So those are great points. And thank you for raising those.
Can I jump in there for a second?
Sure.
And you bring up a good point by those lessons learned. So as you look at my bio, my last profession was I was part of the 189, Brigade, First Army, which First Army is the pillar to help train our National Guard and reservists. And I was in the West with those organizations. And we did a lot of lessons learned based on when we sent our National Guard and reserves to do what they were called to do based on the government letting them go do what they had to do. Problem we have with this is these folks, we couldn't have done it without them. But I don't think we prepared them enough. Because, like you said, they have two professions. They had the civilian job, and they're soldiers. But 2 weeks out of a year, and 1 week out of a month, we say, okay, let's send them through a drill, and then give them some part of a formation. Versus what I did, or what Steve did, we did every day. I was soldiering every day, so the mental capacity, I at least had some of that already. And I think we didn't prepare them enough to be successful, but it was good enough to go. So that was one of the things I tried to work on when I was in Fort Lewis, Washington in the 189.
And I can't say enough for the valor of those National Guardsmen and women and what they did. With the positions we put them in, our security team, and we had great leadership with Bo Barnett, the two-time Ranger instructor, Command Sergeant Major, one of the best in the entire Army. But our team ended up being the model for maneuver when the new BSO came out, the new BCT came out. Because of what those kids could do. So it is amazing what our citizen soldiers and sailors can do when they come out. There's no end to what they can. They just need better support. And I think we have to be accountable for the failures of imagination, of thinking through what they are going to face, over the years, and helping them out. We don't have a chief of staff of retired Army, a chief of staff or CNO of the retired Navy. I think we should do a whole lot better job reaching out to them after these kind of things that we've asked them to do, because it's phenomenal performance they provided out downrange.
I have a vision of this large room in which the lesson learned forms that we filled out and submitted after each one of the adventures that we participated in, because I don't think anybody reads those things. I don't know where they went, but I have that Raiders of the Lost Ark image. Sorry, Sal, to step on you. Go ahead.
No, I've just I didn't expect we'd go down this road, but I'm glad we did, because it just had me thinking, and it's part of the larger conversation with our reservists or our National Guard that I hope people in the right places will continue to look at ways we can do things better. A lot of the individual stories, I know there was he was halfway through his second tour in Kabul, back-to-back, a U.S. Navy Reserve Lieutenant Commander. Remember, this was 08-09, where the economy was absolutely in a nightmarish place. He had his own business that went belly up, which is why he deployed, first of all, because he needed enough money. And during his first deployment, his wife divorced him. And he finagled to get another. So he wound up spending over 2 years in Kabul simply because he just said, I got nothing to go home to. There are a lot of stories like that. And as my co-host knows better than I do, with the reservist, when you walk off the tarmac, it gets very, very quiet, very fast, and trying to get work done. Speaking of cultures and things to get done, Bo, you'll appreciate this. I used to joke that as we're working all the tribal issues in Afghanistan and NATO, we had our own tribal issues with the German tribe, the American tribe, the British tribe, the Italian tribe, and then our own little services tribe. And there I was, a 20-year Navy commander, and I had a U.S. Army E4 look at me and go, "Where's your hand receipt?" I had no idea what a hand receipt was, so I got the E4 mafia schooled me pretty hard on the importance of a hand receipt, why I shouldn't lose them. But you had a chance to soak with some sailors for an extended length of time, and I'm just curious, from a career senior Army NCO having to work with the sailors, what was part of the Navy culture that really kind of got your attention the most in either a positive or a negative way relative to the Army culture and how y'all work things?
Hey, you know, that's a good question. Captain Dill and I, we talked a lot about the difference in culture. And there's a huge difference in culture when it comes to training. I had these, 30, 40 sailors, different skill set, and we were out doing the ranges and all that training in Albury. And the best thing ever happened was I got to spend a little time with them and understand the culture of the Navy, because, I was always told that ships belongs at seas and sailors belongs on ships, but we weren't on a ship. We were at sea. We were going to Afghanistan. So I tried to, put a little bit of the ground tactics on these sailors, but I also had to listen that they came with a skill set, a OS or LS1 or an intel officer or we get these these different skill sets, and then I got an infantry platoon. So I had to figure out, I got to find a happy medium, because one day I had a sailor walking across Chapman carrying that weapon like a briefcase, and I go, "Hey sailor, you ready at the weapon?" And they're like, "Roger that, Sergeant Major." But it took a lot of getting them there, because that's not the normal thing to do. But at the end of the day, everybody on that PRT brought something to the plate. Nobody was, a disconnect. They knew we all had a mission. It's like an offensive line. Yeah, the tackle is not going to get a pass ever, but he knows that he's got a block so we can make a pass happen. So it was different. It was hard for me, and I came off a little harsh on him because I have a background, airborne ranger. Not that it's a bad background, but we had to make sure that we're disciplined before we become part of something bigger than ourselves. And that's what I think the Army put me in this situation. And at the end of the day, if it didn't come to a head, but I get to meet the best Navy officer I ever met in my life, Captain Steve Dill, and we're still friends. So I tell people, "Hey, I was in the Navy for a year," and they go, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, and I learned a lot. Thanks."
I would say the same. I was in the Army for a year, and I was wearing an Army uniform, and I learned a whole lot too. And lately, I think leaders in the last 10 years or so complain about or worried about our sailors and grit. You probably hear that, toughness, and they look back to stories of World War II. There was incredible stories of courage, and those seem to be never ending. And hoping, I think, that sailors will internalize those things, but warfighters belong where the war is, I think. And those who went over to Afghanistan, I think that kind of grit and determination they learned, everyone shone in their own way. And people surprise you how well they react, especially with incoming fire. And I was always amazed by how well everyone did on that team. But we were pretty strong. When we got there, we got stronger as we went through crises and other things. We learned a whole lot from each other. And I think those relationships that we gained are the most lasting and the ones that mean the most to us for the rest of our lives. So that's what I would add.
Well, gentlemen, you've given up an hour of your time to be with us and really appreciate it. Before we let you go, let me ask you if you have any closing thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners about your experiences in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I want to first say, you know, I appreciate the time to have a conversation, an honest conversation, which, you know, sometimes I don't think we have an honest conversation in what we do in the profession. You know, the four of us on this call or this podcast have served our country. But we got to remember, you know, we are in the best country in the world. We have men and women signing up to do something bigger than what they are and be a part of something bigger than them. And, you know, everybody wants to be a part of it. Everybody wants to do right. But I think that we have to lead these young, you know, officers and enlisted into something with some kind of, you know, return on investment. You know, Steve always said to me, "Hey, bro, you know what? The most amazing thing in the world is nobody. What happens when nobody? You know, when it's amazing what happens when nobody cares who gets the credit. You know, everybody's sticking their chest out like me. You know, and my favorite saying is what JFK said: it's not what your country can do for you, it's what you can do for your country. So I just want to appreciate everybody that's been, you know, swinging for the fence for this 20-year war, and then, you know, we all look back and say, hey, we're not there anymore. Was it worth it? That's a good question. You know, you ask most people, they'll say no. But you ask some people that, you know, hey, I think if we save one Afghan kid and he comes out to be, you know, great, it was worth it to me. You know, we're Department of Defense. People are going to die. Things are going to happen. That's what we do. You know, it's like, you know, if it was a NASCAR driver, you have an accident, you die. It's what we do. We're Department of Defense. Thanks.
Yeah, and I agree with everything Bo just said. And, you know, again, you know, there's the issues, strategy, and, you know, we were operators there. We were participants. But it was amazing how many times I was asked by senior leaders to come out to us and meet us at the gate or whatever out on the coast, you know, hey, what's our strategy out here? What are we doing? I'm like, well, I'm an O5. You know, I think I know what we're doing. And, you know, before we go into these wars, before we go downrange and try to meet political, you know, ends with our ways and means, it's just the fact that those kind of people we're talking about who are willing to raise their right hand and serve a cause greater than themselves, just the fact that we have, you know, mothers and fathers who send their daughters and sons out to do that and go into harm's way, that's something to take very, very seriously about when we decide to go into these kind of conflicts and how long we stay. And I know that was probably on the president's mind when he made the decision to do this. It can't be a gut check. It has to be something that we've thought about for a long time. And we have to understand clearly the nature of the war we're going into. And, you know, did we do that? I think it's worth a lot of study over the next 40 or 50 years to understand well after I'm gone, to think about, you know, what lessons did we really learn over those 20 years, $1 trillion or more, and most importantly, all those lives we've lost and the families of the fallen. So thanks a lot. Thanks again for the opportunity, you guys, for talking about this. It means a lot to both of us.
And Steve and Bo, it's just been a pleasure spending the hour with you, and there's just so much more to cover indeed. And listen to y'all talk, and also a couple things we talked about in the pre-show, just for the listeners out there. I think it's really healthy for not just us as individuals, but for our friends and shipmates we serve with, and secondarily also good for the service and the nation, that those of us who serve together, we really should be talking to each other, right? Especially with the events of the last couple of months. I think it's healthy, it's good. And while some of these things, I know it's been, you know, 10 years since y'all were together there, but it's funny how a decade, when you get down with somebody and talk, that it can seem like 2 weeks ago, not 10 years ago. So I appreciate the opportunity for y'all coming on and for y'all sharing your insight and reflections. And I hope, Bo, as a fellow Southerner, I feel for you, brother. It's Vermont's nasty, but at least Steve invited you to come up there in October, not the end of February, March. But I hope y'all have a great visit and a great reminder of the year through the holiday season.
Yeah, thanks again, gentlemen, for being with us.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrat. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy, and in deference to Command Sergeant Major, a good Army day as well. Until next time, cheers.
Goddamn.